David Mitchell is arguably one of the best novelists writing today. His books include Cloud Atlas and Black Swan Green. Paris Review describes David Mitchell's books as ambitious, formally complex, imaginatively powerful, and immaculately written. David Mitchell's new book is called The Bone Clocks. He brings back many characters from his previous books. I asked David Mitchell why he does that in all his books.
The reason has changed. In the beginning, first one or two books, because it pleased me to do so, and because I hoped that then, therefore, it would please the reader. Second stage was because I noticed that if you believe in a character in book A, and that character then appears in book B, they bring that, there must be a word in German for this, they bring that sort of reality concreteness with them and spill it, sort of imbue the new book, book B, with it. More recently, I've discovered that it's a way of sort of having my cake as a maximalist and eating it as a minimalist as well, by which I mean I do like the idea of throwing all my creative life into making one massive Middle-earth or Westeros, but I also really want to write individual books that are not prequels and are not sequels and that are about very, very different things and could theoretically have been written by different people, stylistically. So to square this circle, I've discovered I can kind of make this fictional world. It's not a place so much as a world that's made by character connectivity, by characters from previous books, and they make a kind of a matrix or a web of something larger than the individual books, which means that all of my books are sort of chapters in a larger Uber book. That pleases me too.
One of the things that many of us admire about the narrative style of your books is how remarkably intricate it is and how all these disparate pieces fit together kind of perfectly, different characters, different time periods. And I'm wondering how you go about bringing that unique structure to your books. Do you write the stories out and then figure out how you're going to weave them together? It seems immensely complex.
It's kind of imposed on me by the fact that, in a sense, I'm not really a novelist. I'm a writer of novellas. And my novels are made out of shorter chunks. I like that narrative arc that's sort of about 80 to 130, 150 pages long. It's enough time to get going and get your teeth into the subject matter and to give the cast a character arc, but it's not so long that you risk getting boring. And so the intricacies you refer to aren't really there for their own sake. They're there as a result of the fact that I need to make things add up, I need to glue them together, I need to hyperlink them, I need to weave them into one larger thing, build them into a larger structure like Lego.
You've spoken about having recurring whack-a-mole themes in your books. Yeah. Which ones reappear in this book, The Bone Clocks?
All of them. They always do. That's why they're whack-a-mole themes. But problems with communication or miscommunication or not knowing what's going on is one. Another is predacity, predation, things feeding off other things, prey.
David Mitchell is telling us about his latest book called The Bone Clocks. You've said that as a child, books by Oregon writer Ursula K. Le Guin and Isaac Asimov transported you and kind of inspired you to want to try to write and transport others. Where do these books transport you to?
Well, the world that they make. In Ursula Le Guin's case, it's a fantastical world. Earthsea, or the planets on which her almost unparalleled science fiction is written on, her deeply cerebral, clever pieces of genre fiction. Asimov, it's the place where his Foundation trilogy is set. These other worlds, but it doesn't have to be genre fiction. Sort of, if you read anything that's good, then you are in the world of that book, and we've all had that experience as readers. When writing goes well, then the world we are reading about becomes more real than the world we are actually reading the book in. All books are Narnia in a sense when they work well, and we come back hopefully refreshed and invigorated and maybe more curious and maybe more imaginatively stimulated people. That's why reading is the ultimate benign drug. It is mind-expanding, like LSD is supposed to be mind-expanding, but unlike chemical drugs, they have none of the nasty, negative, damaging side effects. The side effects are good ones. They have the potential to make you wiser, kinder, less lonely human beings. So let's hear it for reading.
And you can read fairly continuously, unlike many drugs, which you should not probably take continuously.
I think our metaphor is collapsing under its own weight here. But yes, I agree with your point.
Did you always assume I'm going to be making a living writing?
Naively, when I was a kid, actually, I think I did, without the faintest idea about how hard it is or what's actually involved. I thought, well, you know, I don't have to focus too much on any one thing because there's always writing. When I become a writer, I'll be able to do this. And how naive I was. I didn't have a clue. But sometimes that kind of impetuosity can actually be an ally, because maybe sometimes it stops you thinking about the real obstacles that are there, which might deter you from this and set you on another path in life. But yeah, it was there throughout most of my youth. And then when I began to feel the cold breath of the real world in my mid-20s, teaching English in Japan and realising, well, actually, I can't do this forever, really. Or I can, but it'll start to become a bit of a one-way street if I do. That was when I realised that I needed to get disciplined about it and actually get rid of the social life and the TV. Didn't have the internet in those days, thank heaven, so that was one distraction I didn't need to combat. It's not enough to be talented, I realise. Loads of people are talented, but you need, just like your stern old school principal would have said perhaps long ago, you need discipline as well as talent. That's what kind of, one without the other is no good.
Did you have to abolish those distractions before you finished your first novel?
Before my -1 novel, in a sense. I mean, I wrote something that in a sense was my creative writing course, and you can't finish it unless you have abolished those distractions, yeah. The good news is, for aspiring writers listening to this, is that you reach a point where, if you are a writer, if it's sort of what you're by nature nurture geared to be, you reach a kind of a feedback loop where the satisfaction you're getting from finishing a scene, finishing a short unit that novel's made up of, that satisfaction gives you the buzz. That gets you addicted into, like, that's the writer's drug rather than the reader's drug, in a sense. That's your fix to then need to write the next scene and the next scene and the next scene and the next scene. So actually, you need the discipline in the early, in kind of the early stages. But if you are a writer and if what you're writing works, you then kind of need the discipline to stop and remember to go and pick the kids up because it's 3:30.
David Mitchell is telling us about his latest book called The Bone Clocks. Finally, David Mitchell, you've said that the business and media side of being a writer takes you away from your family, of course. It also disrupts your writing. But you said that to kind of get over that, you try to get well into your next book before the most recently one is published. So you've kind of got a head start on where you're going. So I assume you're working on your next novel, and I know you're always loath to talk too much about it because it could change between now and then, but is there anything you can say about what you're working on now?
Well, thank you for your interest. Thanks for wanting to know, even if I'm not going to be that forthcoming. It's a short book. It's sort of, when I wrote The Bone Clocks, I spent about 6-8 months going wrong, and that's normal. I do that with all of the books. It takes that long to find out what the book really is. But I made some stories in that time that they didn't make it into the final cut of The Bone Clocks, and they weren't really part of the book, and that was why. But I like them, and I don't just want them to be lost, so I'm expanding them a little bit and giving them a home. It's got a supernatural element, probably, and one of the characters from The Bone Clocks appears at the very end. Yeah, that's what I'm working on now, in planes, and kind of if I have a spare quarter hour in restaurants or hotels. It just reminds me I'm a writer and not a kind of strange form of travelling salesman in the employ of The Bone Clocks.
David Mitchell, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Tomorrow, novelist David Mitchell talks about what he says is his most important book. He didn't even write it. It's a translation he did of a memoir written by an autistic Japanese boy called Why I Jump. This is The Record on KUOW.